Good evening, and welcome to the June 2017 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. Our first order of business this evening will be the approval of the minutes of our last meeting from May the 8th, 2017. Any additions or corrections from anyone? If not, we will publish them as they have been presented to us. Now is the time in our agenda when we invite public comment. Any persons desiring to speak on issues other than those that are on scheduled items on our agenda that are within the scope of interest of the Health Commission are invited to come to the podium. Seeing no public comment, we'll go ahead and begin with our program for this evening. And I'm going to ask Commissioner Candace to present our program this evening. She has been very instrumental in putting it together, and I think it's a wonderful program.
Great, thank you. So tonight we're going to hear from David Kilborn from the Access Support Network about hepatitis C linkage to care and testing through a demonstration grant that the Access Support Network got from the state of California. Before he gives his presentation, though, I'm going to put my microbiology hat on. And I'm going to give a little bit of background first about hepatitis C. Okay, so we're talking about hepatitis C, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about the life cycle of the virus, what the disease is in brief, and some of the epidemiology. I would like to front this with the fact that I am not a hepatitis C expert. I did get my degree in microbiology and immunology, but any detailed questions I'll probably have to either read about or refer you to someone that's more expert than myself. Okay, so. Just because there's several different causes of viral hepatitis, I kind of wanted to put hepatitis C in context. So you may have heard of hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C. In medicine and biology, we like the alphabet soup nature of naming things. So hepatitis A is the one I would want if I was going to get a hepatitis virus. It's acquired through a fecal-oral route. It's endemic to certain regions. And the reason I would want it is it's relatively short-lived. Usually you get an acute version of the disease unless you have any underlying conditions. Usually no long-term liver damage, again, if you have no underlying conditions. And there's a vaccine available. So if you know you're traveling to an area that's endemic for hepatitis A, you can get vaccinated, and that's great. Hepatitis B is the blood-borne virus that can be transmitted through contaminated blood or other fluids, through sexual transmission as well. This virus can lead to a chronic situation that causes liver damage, including cirrhosis and cancer, but there's an effective vaccine available for hepatitis B as well, and this is one of the ones that's scheduled in newborns in the first several months, up to a year of the baby's life. So hepatitis C, there is no vaccine for this virus yet. I did read a bunch about that, and there's some things in the works, but not super soon. It is also a bloodborne virus. It's highly infectious, and it, in 75% or so of cases, can become chronic and lead to liver damage, including cancer and cirrhosis. So that's the virus that we're going to be focusing on tonight. This is what it looks like. So the transmission electron micrograph is up in the top left corner. It's an enveloped virus, so it acquires its envelope from the host as it's leaving the cell. I think that's very cool. It is a member of the Flaviviridae family, so it has a single-stranded RNA genome. And it has a very beautiful icosahedral core, which you can see a symmetrical shape in the middle of that virus. The genome in there is that red squiggly line in the middle. In terms of what the disease itself looks like that this virus causes, the acute disease is usually mostly asymptomatic or mild. You can see signs of the viral infection anywhere between 2 weeks to 6 months post-exposure, which is a pretty wide window. But 75 to 80%, regardless of whether they've shown symptoms before, will become chronically infected. Those that are chronically infected can be remain asymptomatic for a long time, so they can be carriers of this virus and pass it on to other folks. And 5 to 20% of these folks will go on to get serious liver damage, cirrhosis, and 1 to 5% of them will get liver cancer. Some of the symptoms of a progressing chronic infection of hepatitis C would include vomiting, more abdominal pain, swelling in the extremities and the abdomen, dark urine, gray stool, joint pain, and jaundice. So things associated with liver damage, that's the target organ. This is a slide that I stole from, I can't remember where from, looking at hepatitis C disease progression, just to kind of give you a flavor for the chronic progression of the disease. So acute can be short-term, mostly asymptomatic, but again, a high proportion of those folks will go on to develop the chronic form, which goes through several different phases of liver damage through the decades. So this can go on from 10 to 50 years, resulting in the potentially fatal liver cancer. This is what the viral life cycle looks like. This is where I said I geeked out a tiny bit. I can't talk about a virus without a little viral life cycle. So on the lower left corner, we have the virus entering the cell, binding its receptor. Fun fact, the receptor is the low-density lipoprotein receptor, in case you were wondering. And it'll get internalized into the cell, where it will uncoat and release its DNA into the cytoplasm of the cell. It does not need to replicate its genome right at that point. It can go straight to making viral proteins. The viral proteins are shown along the bottom of the slide, and the reason I like to geek out, but I also wanted to show this slide because it shows some of the targets for the antiviral medication. And so the last 5 years or so, we've seen a really big change in the treatments that are available for hepatitis C. And so these are targeting those purple proteins at the bottom are called non-structural proteins. And these treatments target several of these different non-structural proteins. And I'll leave the details for the true geeks. So in terms of the natural history of the progression, I kind of already said this, but I want to get into epidemiology, and this illustrates a point that I was going to make there, which is that the progression can be really variable. So there are things that make hepatitis C infection progress faster, and that might include alcohol use or if you're male. And so that can really narrow that window of chronic progression towards symptoms quite a bit, depending on what else is going on. In addition, the genotype of the virus can matter there as well. So in terms of treatments, like I said, the treatment has really changed in the last few years. So the current treatment that's recommended by the CDC and the World Health Organization are using a cocktail of direct-acting antiviral agents, or DAAs. So again, these target several non-structural proteins. NS3, NS5 are the main ones there. And the efficacy of these cocktails really can depend on the genotype, but there's some fluidity with the cocktails that are used because resistance can develop over the course of the treatment, and so using several of these drugs can be necessary. But the really, really great news is that there's a 90 to 95% cure rate. So this is also a shorter duration of treatment than folks had to use before. So within 8 to 12 weeks, people can be cleared of the virus with less side effects. I did want to mention, reading a bunch of things on this field of hepatitis C treatment, this is a pretty fast-moving target. So the protocols seem to be changing relatively quickly as new medications come online, so it's something you would want to check with a doctor about. So moving on to epidemiology, some of the more at-risk populations for hepatitis C are people who, anybody that's exposed to blood, really. So people who inject drugs, current or in the past. Folks who are HIV positive may have also acquired hepatitis C with those risk behaviors. If you received a blood transfusion before 1992 or clotting factor before 1987, if you've ever been incarcerated, or babies born to hepatitis C positive women, and healthcare workers exposed to infected blood, And finally, the baby boomers, so those that were born between 1945 and 1965 have the highest incidence of chronic hepatitis C, and so those are the folks that the CDC is also recommending testing. In terms of global prevalence, this is a slide I definitely stole from the World Health Organization. So 71 million people currently have chronic hepatitis C. 399,000 die each year from complications resulting from liver failure or cancer. And each year it's estimated that 1.75 million new infections occur. And you can see the darker areas there are areas of more prevalence. Within the United States, reported new infections have been really increasing in the last 5 years. So the latest morbidity and mortality weekly report had the infections tripling. So they're at a 15-year high right now. They are highest, new infections are highest in 20 to 29-year-olds. So these are people that are just acquiring hepatitis C. And the CDC estimates that about 34,000 Americans get infected each year with hepatitis C. More die of this viral complications from this virus than any other disease that's reported to the CDC. And 20,000 died of hepatitis C-related causes in 2015. These folks were mostly 55 and older. Again, getting back to those baby boomers, 75% of Hep C infected people are baby boomers. They're 6 times more likely to have been infected and have a chronic infection and more likely to die than any other age group. The other population that's really getting careful tracking is maternal to child hepatitis C transmission, and those were doubling in the last 5 years. In terms of California, we have a little bit of a different story than at the national level, and there's various explanations for it, but if you look from 2009 to 2013, when this is the newest data from the CDPH, the rates appear to be mostly decreasing or stable over those years. We do see, if you look at the lower graph, that's male, and always pay attention to the axis, and you can see that it's more prevalent, hepatitis C is more prevalent in males. No, I didn't say this is chronic hep C. Newly reported chronic hep C. You can also see from this graph, when you look at the top two lines in both graphs, that those are the older age groups, so it's more prevalent in baby boomers. If you compare this epidemiology to the same set of data, same years in the prisons, those cases are a lot younger, and there is more increase in the younger population, so it's actually not declining in that population, which does not bode well for the future, actually. If we look by county, since we wanted to try to get a little bit at what's going on in SLO County, this is comparing 2011 to 2013, the rates of newly reported cases. And generally, what you can see if you kind of look at the whole state is that it appears to be more prevalent in rural areas. It's more prevalent in northern versus southern California, and there's kind of a hot spot in the Bay Area. Also notice SLO County down there, which I labeled for myself. It is actually more prevalent than the state as a whole, newly reported hep C, chronic hep C. So to summarize the California data and kind of head towards SLO County, the newly reported chronic hep C decreased in California from 2009 to 2013. 54% of folks that were newly testing positive for hepatitis C were baby boomers, so that's like the national level. There's a gender disparity similar to at the national level. The strongest correlation between testing positive was having previous or current injection drug use. 13% of newly reported cases were from state prisons, and this was a younger population. Looking at the county level, the chronic hepatitis C rates appeared to be stable over the last several years, but they were definitely higher than statewide rates. I don't have a good number for the hepatitis C rates. That was sort of difficult to obtain, but I think that David Kilbourn will have some information for us about what's going on in the county. So I'd like to turn the presentation over to the Executive Director of the Access Support Network, David Kilbourn, and we'll hear about his cool project.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us here today to talk a bit about the project that we're currently doing right now with hepatitis C linkage to care. Let me back up just for a bit. Our name, Access Support Network, is new to us, but we've been in the community for 30 some years. We were formerly known as the AIDS Support Network or the Slow Hep C Project. Then 2 years ago, we expanded into Monterey County, so we kind of thought the name needed to be reflective of what we were doing, so we changed our name to Access Support Network. So as I said, back in 1999, we saw quite a few of our HIV clients were also co-infected with Hep C, and there weren't really a lot of services or knowledge of Hep C in our community. So we got a grant to do sort of a needs analysis in the community, and were then awarded a grant from the California Endowment to start our Hep C project. That was also a demonstration project 15 years ago or so. So fast forward to now, we've been delivering hepatitis C linkage to care services and case management all this time. So an opportunity through some advocacy that we're involved in at the state, there were $3 million set aside for demonstration projects to, there were three different goals. I guess I can follow my PowerPoint presentation. Anyway, David Kilburn, Access Support Network. So there were three goals of this demonstration RFA. Goal one was using surveillance to improve Hep C outcomes. So that was at sort of at a county level. Butte County, well, there were five recipients for all of these goals. Goal one was awarded to Butte County Public Health. Goal two was to conduct targeted hepatitis C rapid testing and linkage to care. We, under goal two, were awarded, as well as the Family Health Centers of San Diego and the San Francisco Health Department. Goal three was sort of more clinical setting on how to improve care in the clinics, and that was awarded to St. John's Child and Family Center. So, this is a three-year demonstration grant. The first year was a short year. By the time the state got the grant RFA put together and RFAs brought in and reviewed, we really didn't start our project until March of last year. So the first year was just like a three-month short fiscal year. So we're in our second year right now. So our target population is anyone, people who have injected present or past, secondary baby boomers. The state's really wanting us to look for people who inject. So you can see in the first part of the graph is non-IDU community, and then ever injected is the next column. So far we have tested in this county 342, and this is data as of April 30th, sorry. So there's a little data lag with the state getting our numbers out of here. So 138 people, let's move forward a little bit here. So what the steps are with hepatitis C, we're doing a rapid test, a finger stick, and within 20 minutes we'll get a result of antibodies for Hep C. That doesn't mean you have Hep C. As Candace said, about 30% of people may clear the virus on their own, so what we need to do is get another RNA test to look for the actual virus. So that's a blood draw. So in this cascade of care, from identifying people, testing them, linking them to care, getting them in treatment, and curing the virus, there's a lot of points that people can fall out of care and not move to that next step in the treatment cascade. So one of the big things right now is, as we're doing outreach in, say, drug and alcohol settings or in homeless encampments, we get a rapid test result is positive, so we need to explain to people, you need to get an RNA test done, and here's a lab requisition. Boom, already we have transportation issues, barriers of just access to healthcare, people's fear of just getting into the system. So this grant is to identify all of those barriers and try to find solutions so we can move people through and get them cured. One of the biggest problems that we're having right now is not having on-site phlebotomy at our testing events. So you'll see here, as people are getting their results, there's a big drop-off in, as you see here, we find somebody that's positive in the first graph there. Second graph is we let them know their results. Then there's a huge decline in following through. So what we're trying to do is bring phlebotomists on-site to drive people to the lab if they're willing right then, or just giving people bus passes or incentives. So once we get someone to the lab and then get their actual results of if they have RNA, we're successfully keeping them in care and linking them to their initial doctor's visit. One other thing in this grant that's coming through is the people that put out the RFP, the state, really kind of thought that that would be the logical way of the field, people in the community, testing and then just doing a handoff to that first appointment and everything would be fine. But as we've seen in 16 years of serving a population that is not connected to healthcare traditionally, so we're seeing that to keep people in care and following through the treatment cascade, they need a lot of case management, travel assistance, all kinds of things, stable housing. There's food insecurities that take priority over getting to the doctor and trying to figure out who's going to pay for the meds. So that's where we're coming in, where our goal two, that was just to link, to sort of hand them the person off to that initial visit, that isn't enough. They're not continuing through the whole process of care. A lot of numbers here, I apologize, but it kind of all makes sense when you look at it every day. This, again, is just showing that big drop-off from where people get their antibody result after that 20 minutes and then getting them linked to care. So 50 people right now, let me just go through some of these and it'll make a little more sense here in a second. San Luis Obispo, we clearly have a larger percentage of our white or Caucasian Nexus Hispanic that are testing positive. As we see on this graph, the red is anybody who is ever injected. The blue is people that do not identify as having injected. So our largest is unstable housing. It appears to be a major risk, current or in the last 12 months. Incarcerated in the last 12 months is also quite high, and then that baby boomer generation just seems to be persistent. Most of our clients that we're reaching are on Medi-Cal, or we are connecting them to Medi-Cal. Different barriers that people identify as to why they're not able to move through that treatment cascade. A lot of people just need reminders. They have competing priorities in life, as I said, having no shelter, food insecurities, there's things that just are more important than them getting to that doctor's visit in their mind. So we try to offer reminders. We are actually, through the grant, able to provide people with what we call burner phones, and they're good for 30 days, and what we do is give them an activated cell phone, and then the case manager will stay in contact with them and remind them of an appointment that's upcoming and try to arrange transportation if needed, which then up above there is, transportation is a very big issue. And a lot of people are requesting a case manager to go with them to the lab or to their doctor's visits, which we try to accommodate. Some of the reasons that people have fallen out of care is we're just not able to locate people. If we test somebody, say, at the Circle down at Bob Jones Trail, and we go back in a couple weeks and they're not there. We will sometimes run into people at another location in South County, maybe. And so we'll We connect with people like a year later at times and go, hey, we never followed up on your labs. Can we get you over to the lab right now? So it's kind of a challenge. Our case managers are amazing. Let's see here. This kind of goes to that, what I was just pointing about, how long it can take. One person, maximum days, 118 days to attend their first appointment. And that's just us trying to follow them and provide them the resources they need. And maybe they're just not ready at that point when they get that test result to know where they, you know, where they stand. There's still stigma around Hep C. There's still ignorance around Hep C. People just don't know what it is. Those that we're finding that are aware of previous treatments are often fearful of knowing because of that perception of the interferon for a year making you deathly ill. So we're trying to educate people also that treatments are very effective with minimal side effects. So it's just sort of a challenge. Sometimes we can get people right in, other times we're, you know, 6 months down the road, we're still not connected. These are some of the test sites that we've done that have yielded really promising results that we're reaching our target audience. Through drug and alcohol services, we are coming up with 26% positivity. Drug and alcohol in Grover Beach, 22%. Aegis Treatment Center, 20%. And then, although that's not our name, the state still thinks it is, the AIDS Support Network. We have 14% of people just walking into our office, or 17% just of people walking into our office to be tested. So that was a bit surprising to me. I didn't think that was going to happen. And then again, the Circle Bob Jones Trail is one of our percentage. Some of the other numbers are skewed because the numbers, the N is so low on those. So like only one person at the tunnel. Anyway, these are just by facility type. The state loves data, and I love their support and their money to be able to deliver the programs here, but every way you can crunch numbers, they will. So drug and alcohol, slow public health, 29%. So let's see here, just another way of looking at it. Let's see. Anyway, that is our programs. I think Candace did a great overview of, you know, what the virus is, but I'd really like to try to present what the impact of Hep C is doing in our community and the dollar cost, but then just also that the human cost that we're seeing. It's a devastating disease. Although it's slow progressing, end-stage liver disease and the effects that a dysfunctional liver can do are horrifying. A lot of times as someone progresses in their disease state, their liver stops producing, stops working, and they'll get high levels of ammonia. And it causes the effects of that can often appear to be like, look like somebody's under the influence. So often, say a homeless shelter or, you know, people will present looking drunk and they're kicked out, where actually it's a medical need that they need to be taken to the ER so they can get treatment for that lactic, the ammonia buildup. The ascites, which is giant swelling of the abdomen, is awful to see, actually. So I think it's just raising the awareness in our community and knowing that hepatitis C is curable and that everyone deserves that cure and everyone deserves access to healthcare in our community. So we're very appreciative at ASN that the county has been very supportive over the last almost 20 years in funding our program and sustaining the work that we do. So kind of you get those demonstration grants and you're able to sustain them over the years is quite remarkable. So I think We're at a place in our community that we have the support, hopefully, but we just need to put it all into action and just raise awareness. So if you have any questions, I hopefully could answer them.
Well, I'm sure we will have some questions. One quick one. You mentioned that sometimes when these people present, they do appear to be under the influence, and that's misunderstood. What are we doing about educating people at our facilities, our shelters, or whatever, to recognize that as a legitimate illness?
Right, yeah. We do go to the shelters and the different food programs and explain what to look for if someone is presenting with those symptoms, and maybe, and also trying to let the client know that they can sometimes communicate that this is a health issue, and you know, but it's educating our community and those frontline workers as to what's happening. And then we'll also, if there's times that we will, caseworkers will go to an appeal, say if someone is wanting to get back into the shelter, and we can go at that point and work with them and say they're in case management with us and try to work with that appeal.
Good. Questions from other commissioners? Yeah. Commissioner Campbell. Oh, let's start to my right and go down. Okay.
You know, first of all, thank you for this heroic effort. It's remarkable listening to it. What is the cost of the optimal drug cocktail to a cure?
Okay. Everybody remembers when the first drug came out, it was $1,000 a pill, and it's going to be $84,000 a treatment cycle. Well, there's four different companies right now with meds out that are directly competing with one another, and the price has dropped dramatically. So it's still expensive, but if you're only doing a duration of 12 weeks as opposed to end-stage liver disease and transplantation that could cost upwards of $700,000, $24,000, say, for a duration of treatment is a good investment in a lot of our minds. So it's still expensive, but the price is coming down.
It sounds like a bargain. It also looks like the 80 or 90% of those who are antibody positive are also RNA positive, if you can get them in the lab. Did I read that right?
Roughly 20 to 30% of people will clear the virus. So they're always going to be antibody positive, but those that are in chronic hepatitis C will be living with the virus, roughly 70 to 80%. Yeah.
So I imagine you don't have any good data on this, but do you have an estimate of the people who are antibody positive but who do not get RNA testing? The majority of those still have active disease. Mm-hmm. They're still communicable. Do you have any sense of how much further they spread this in the,
well,
until you get them back and get them on treatment?
Well, that's, that is definitely a risk. And that's why we are trying to get people connected, doing everything we can throughout the state to work for those hard to reach populations. There's big push throughout the state right now to engage more communities to allow the syringe exchange. That's critical to get people into care and the supplies they need. The virus, hepatitis C, is a really hardy virus, whereas HIV is really pretty fragile. So if you get blood on the table or something, the virus of Hep C might last as long as days to, if not weeks sometimes. Numbers vary on the estimates, but it's a much hardier virus, so we really feel we need to do everything we can to get people in care, and if they're ready for treatment, cured. And then we also talk about reinfection. So again, syringe exchange is very important for people injecting to have the supplies they need and the education they need. So.
Well, again, thank you for heroic effort in a really difficult situation.
Thank you.
You might have already said this, but my understanding was Medi-Cal does pay for the treat bully.
Yes, Medi-Cal will pay. There are there's eligibility factors. I mean, if you have a zero F score or one in the F score, which is the fibrosis level, they're probably going to get a denial from mm-hmm. Medi-Cal, and I think that's just a actuarial, the dollars and cents, they have to figure out who's going to get it first. But there's also a push right now, because it's curable, get everyone in and get it cured. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you have a really high F score and cirrhosis, Medi-Cal is very good right now. CenCal is very good about paying.
That's great.
Yeah.
I have kind of a logistical question, and maybe I'm just jealous, but did the state crunch all your numbers for you and give you those graphs back?
The program we're using is based on, it's called LEO, and it's, I don't even know what the acronym stands for anymore, but it's the testing, HIV testing and surveillance data stuff that goes mm-hmm. in. We've been advocating for years that they incorporate Hep C into this database that's being used throughout the state, and they haven't, so now it's sort of an offshoot. To pull our reports take months for the state to be able to pull the numbers out, but we're getting them, and they're looking promising, showing us that big step of getting somebody to take that next step to get that RNA lab draw is the huge barrier mm-hmm. for us right now.
That was really obvious. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a graph, I think it may have been one of yours, that showed, or a map actually, that showed that San Luis County uh-huh. had a higher incident. Is that inclusive of the prison populations that we've got here?
That was not inclusive of the prison
okay,
populations.
Okay, so it did specifically exclude CMC and
yes.
Atascadero.
Yeah, they had another graph that was only the prison population, and then they didn't have the conglomerate.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, just in response to that too, it's always wondering if you have a really active, the community is really active in finding people with Hep C.
Do you have a higher
incidence? As opposed to another county that isn't,
right.
And our numbers start looking higher,
skewed.
Where it's just that we're maybe actively looking.
Right.
But I couldn't really see why the other surrounding counties wouldn't be the same rise. I mean,
right.
Just seeing it everywhere.
I should say that the report that the CDPH put out with that Hep C data had, I think, four or five slides of caveats to carefully read about how mm-hmm. about reporting and about the electronic medical records and how that influenced reporting and mm-hmm. companies that were. So it's complicated.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of to give an overall picture, but I don't know that you would.
Well, and that would make sense because in the Bay Area, where there is more aggressive testing and identification and treatment efforts, it too was even higher yet.
Yes.
So
yeah.
That would make sense. And then another question in more dying after the age of 55, is it found that this is often related to a continuance of substance abuse after an identification of Hep C? Does that have any correlation at all?
I don't really know the answer to that, but hepatitis C is a slow progressing disease that is different in everybody.
Okay.
So it's there could be a lot of factors, so I'm not really sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I could make something up. No.
We could all do that.
Okay.
I'd rather you didn't. We have too much of that.
Yeah.
A quick question. Okay. So you mentioned that once the people are identified with Hep C, that you are linking them with basically go covercalifornia.com, have them sign up for the insurance program, right?
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Most of our clients that we're serving right now are Medi-Cal eligible, so mm-hmm. that eligibility is throughout the year,
mm-hmm.
whereas with somebody that may be income ineligible for Medi-Cal, we'll have to wait till an open enrollment time comes. But we are connecting people
mm-hmm.
to Covered California at
okay.
that point.
Right. So you making sure, but the reason is, so we have patients coming in, they were identified, they were told they have hepatitis C and they're coming in. And we tell them that number one, you making sure that your insurance Sankel is active, mm-hmm. and that you have to do initial physical, and I have to re-identify them, order all necessary hepatitis C of testing for them to be qualified, like FibroSure, to mm-hmm. see what their, you know, their status of liver is, and genotype, because only certain genotype is covered and be treated with hormone treatment. So it's like a long process, and we don't treat them at the primary. We actually have to gather all this information and send them, refer them to a specialist, which is a GI specialist or infection specialist who will actually treat these patients. So it's like several months. By the time they come to us, it takes about 6 months almost sometimes for them to get into infection specialists and start on their heartbone treatment. Now, during that time, one of the things that I've noticed is that they have such a lack of information on infection control. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they come in with their partner. And when I ask them, are you guys using protection? And oftentimes they're not, and which was kind of shocking. So is that an information, do you actually teach them about infection control, that you do have to use a protection with your partner?
Yeah. Going back to one of the things that we're working on right now mm-hmm. at the state level through, say, the California Hepatitis Alliance is to really look at primary care providers being able to prescribe. Because there are medications now that are pangenotypic. They'll cover all the genotypes, Epclusa being one. So I think to be, in our minds, to get more people treated, we need to have the insurance companies allowing the primary care providers to get them in and treated if they need it right then and there. And there's a program called Project ECHO out of UCSF that is a, every other week they have a lunchtime webinar and presentation for providers where experts at UCSF will sort of mentor and do case studies. So that's one way we're trying to get more primary care providers in as treaters. Because the really, our main treating physician here is Dr. Bollet, and she's not a hepatologist, she's an internist. Mm-hmm. So she had a lot of pushback from the insurance companies saying, we're not gonna cover because you're right. not a hepatologist. So she has sort of mastered the prior approval process and is able to get people treated right then and there. You know, because we risk, if we're referring, every referral we make in our mind is a barrier. If you're needing, if you're not getting it right when you need it, you have risk of losing people to the next step. So we're really pushing for expanding treatment. In fact, we are right now beginning a partnership with CHC for their Oceano Clinic to have a mid-level, a PA, do that initial triage and see the mm-hmm. patients first to then say, you know, what is the, looking at the labs, we can treat this person right here as this person has advanced liver disease and really needs to see that specialist, but not just referring everyone to the specialist. So we need to reserve, you can just open it up a bit. So.
All right, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, David, your charts showed and you emphasized the fact that from the initial diagnosis to the follow-up, there's a huge drop. Now, you mentioned you do education, but that seems to be a critical part of your program. What are you doing to try and help that gap narrow from the follow-up appointment to get people in?
We're trying the burner phones. We're trying to bring the phlebotomist on site because what we really are finding, once we are able to let somebody know that they actually have the virus and not they haven't, you know, just cleared the virus is one thing, that's great. But if they're living with the virus, they seem to be more engaged in taking that next step of going to the doctor. And we're also offering incentives, one, to get tested, to go to the lab and get your RNA and then come back to us and get your results. So we're just trying to streamline it to make it as easy and, you know, one-stop shop for everything.
Okay.
So, but yeah, it's a challenge, and that's what this demonstration grant is all about, to identify the barriers. It's, you know, there are many challenges for the population we're trying to reach, whether it's without shelter, without food, or drug addiction, whatever it is, are competing priorities in their life. Where, you know, so we're trying to just assist them to get to that next step. So
okay. Thank you.
Challenge.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your presentation, David. It's just mind-boggling, some of what I'm hearing. What's the sort of time frame you're seeing between when someone's definitely, the lab results prove it, that yes, they've got it, it's got to be treated, how long till CHC actually, which Medi-Cal is maybe the better way to say it, till Medi-Cal approves funding for that patient?
Well, typically what's happening is, I mean, Medi-Cal's paying for the doctor's visits, no problem, but if it's going to be down to the medication, the doctor's usually going to probably meet with them two or three times first to just assess what the needs are and get additional labs to really see if their treatment readiness.
Okay.
They'll work with us a lot to try to, if somebody's homeless, we'll try to find housing resources, or if someone is afraid to have their meds in their backpack on the street, we sometimes will work with that client to say, store your meds in a locked cabinet at our office, come in daily. That's another huge barrier of getting to the lab, where people don't want to leave their things if they're living outside. And so if we can bring that phlebotomist to them, set up an appointment to bring them their results, that's kind of what we're finding is the best thing. Is we just have to try to offer whatever that a solution to whatever that barrier is.
Uh-huh. So. Well, I see these logistics as a nightmare, you know, of trying to keep them and the patient engaged when I just heard two to three more doctor visits of, okay, looking at lab results and really making sure is this patient ready for treatment and so on. It's
but accompanying them to that doctor's appointment really helps.
Yeah, well,
because
certainly.
It's somebody that is going to help them understand what the doctor just said and how to navigate this healthcare system we have.
Yes, exactly.
So I actually have found it quite interesting because there was one encampment, the tunnel under Los Osos Valley Road, and the freeway, and we scaled down this incredible cliff, it seemed like, and we got down there, and the guys that we were testing were like, yeah, by the way, there's a trail around the other side here, you can take that. And I'm like, oh, thanks. But I think we looked rather foolish, but they appreciated our effort, at least.
It's almost back to that common theme, location, location, location.
Yep.
Wow. Baby boomers, they seem to be one of the prevalent segments of the population. Why?
That's an interesting one. I mean, there's a lot of different ideas. The blood wasn't screened for Hep C until 92. And it was known as non-A, non-B. People really didn't know. Medical practices are much better these days. I mean, there were endoscopies and colonoscopies and a lot of the oscopies that, you know, we've even seen recent outbreaks a few years ago in Las Vegas. There was one clinic that had a massive outbreak of Hep C just from not using sterile practice. And I will say a lot, being of that baby boomer generation, a lot of us dabbled a little bit in things. So. So yeah, there's a lot of different risk factors, but it's really interesting when people just cannot list any of the typical risk factors and they're just like, and that's what's so important about educating our baby boomers, get tested.
Okay.
Even if it's a one-time test, just do it.
So that was going to be one of my other questions, is testing important? So let's see, I just had my physical last week. I guess I have to go back to my doctor and said he forgot something.
Well, and we're finding there's a lot of education that needs to happen. A lot of doctors have their perceptions also of who's at risk, and it's like we hear all the time, oh, my doctor said I didn't need a Hep C test because I didn't do X, Y, or Z. And it's like, well, CDC is saying differently.
So. Yeah. So there's been an ad running on television that's got some very well-known local familiar faces in it. So I won't start to name them, but they're all stepping up to the camera and saying, I did, as in they had
I'm
the testing.
I'm glad you saw that ad.
So I didn't know if it was they were going to try and sell me a car in the end of the story, or I didn't know whether to put credibility to that just because those are faces I recognized. But so I guess you'd advocate for someone, baby boomer, to really be advocating to tell my doctor, hey, why are we not testing me?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
That would be wonderful. Or 1320 Napomo, we offer free testing right at our office.
Oh, when are you open tomorrow?
9 o'clock.
Okay, great. Last comment, more feedback from you, which is, so if you really could get your wish as to what could the Board of Supervisors do next? I hear that there's some good funding. The county keeps funding and keeps funding. What's next on your wish list if you could get it out of the board?
You know, great question. I would love to be one of the first counties that really takes ownership of this disease. It's curable. Everyone is worthy of the cure. So, I mean, if we could just take the leadership and show we're a demonstration, we're our county is one of the recipients of this demonstration grant. So the state saw what we were doing. We need to keep the momentum going. We need to keep just getting the word out there, and let's eliminate Hep C from our community.
Oh, very commendable. You need in need of volunteers, as you mentioned, accompanying people to appointments. Mm-hmm. Do you find that you are just lacking the people who are available to do
we
that?
We have an incredible core of volunteers at ASN. It's dedicated folks that just are constantly stepping up. You know, there's time that we need to send our staff to accompany the patient on their own just because of insurance issues and like prior authorizations that we can assist with. And so, but volunteers are always needed. So,
okay, great.
So if you're watching out there,
exactly,
ASN.org.
There you go. Thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you so much, everyone, for.
One last question, David. What's the big barrier to getting the phlebotomists out? Have you worked with the pathology labs and everybody else that has drawing stations?
Yeah, we have a phlebotomist on site at Drug and Alcohol Services tonight with a testing event. So it was just identifying the phlebotomists, and kind of we do testing at strange hours that, you know, there aren't a lot of phlebotomists that are just sitting around looking for, you know, little side work. But we actually just, in Monterey County, we just had two of our staff go through a phlebotomy training up there. Cuesta here is pretty impacted, but it's a long wait list to get in on their phlebotomy classes. So, but yeah, we are looking for phlebotomists now, too, to contract with us.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Commissioner Cameron.
How hard is it to become a phlebotomist?
It was a 12-week course, about 3 months, and then some pretty intense practicum testing. And it really isn't that difficult, but it's expensive. So it's just hard to, you know, we're looking for retired nurses that might want to come in and help us draw or. So we're just kind of exploring that right now. We were really hoping that some of our other approaches would work to get people to a lab, but it's really needing on site right then and there a draw. Hmm. So we're learning.
I have a comment, and I understand about the questions that was posed. How long it takes for the patients to be treated, right, beyond the medication. Like you mentioned, people who are infected with hepatitis C, there's a lot more complication going on, drug addictions, mental health. So I have a patient that I've seen year and a half, 2 years ago, and we already identified they have hepatitis C. I send them to specialists, either number one, they don't even show up to the appointment, or when they do, they don't do the lab. So there's a lot of barriers there, and this is still expensive treatment.
Right.
Price hasn't really come down, and St. Cal has not approved all the other situations. So we really need a commitment from the patient that they'll stick to that program for 3 months, taking the medication right. every day, and that is the huge challenge. So I just want to point that out. And nope. yeah, and then specialists, there we only have a few specialists. This is still pretty remote area. And only a few of them really take the Senkel. So that's another challenge too. Their schedules are like booked for several months to just see them. Yeah, and then when they don't show up, and transportation really is not the issue. We actually CHC provide transportation, but you know, so there's a lot more issue going on than just going to a doctor and taking right. the medication.
No, I absolutely acknowledge that, and that's where we try to really have a partnership with our clients, as we call them, to let them know the importance of that. You know, somebody's waiting for that appointment. But there are challenges in the population we're serving, and you know, I acknowledge what you're saying, absolutely.
Well, and I think it'll help if you can get more primary care that will do the treating. I work with a different county health agency, and in their FQHC, their primary care are treating Hep C, and they have a very active Hep C clinic, but it helps that it's all right there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, again, thank you, both of you. Thank you, Candace, for your part and for putting it together, and David, always nice to see you.
Right,
thank you for
here.
Coming again.
Thanks. Okay.
So Dr. Bornstein isn't with us this evening, but we're happy to have Christy Mulcairn with us, and she is going to do our health agency report for us. Thanks, Christy.
You're welcome. Good evening, everyone. So it's been relatively quiet, knock on wood, in public health these days. We have had our usual number of cases of norovirus, which cause, if you've ever had it, you won't forget, causes severe vomiting and diarrhea and is extremely contagious, passes through any congregate setting very quickly, especially schools and prisons and jail settings, dorms. There were some outbreaks in Santa Barbara County, but we haven't had any in our county recently, just our regular number of cases. We also are hearing from the Center for Disease Control that there is more salmonella linked with backyard chickens. I don't know if you guys have seen that in the news. So we're doing a little bit of outreach. It turns out that a lot of people in the county have backyard chickens, and we have one known salmonella case that's specifically from a backyard chicken in our county. We suspect the number is much higher, but it can be, you can have minimal symptoms with it. You don't always get severe disease. And so we're going to do a little public health campaign to make sure people know. The big message is, of course, wash your hands and don't kiss or snuggle your chickens. And actually, interestingly, washing your eggs is not a good idea if you think that there is chicken poop on your eggs. You're not supposed to wash because the cold water can actually allow the salmonella to enter the inside of the egg. So the thing you're supposed to do is buff your egg with a towel to get the chicken poop off. So yeah, good to know, right? And last but not least, I was speaking with Commissioner Campbell earlier about valley fever. We are still seeing increased valley fever. We have had a few deaths this year. I'll be able to get you guys better numbers next meeting about exactly how our numbers compare this year compared to last year. Most of our deaths are usually associated or have been associated with immunocompromised individuals. But the combination of the rain, which caused the spores to grow and reproduce, and then now the drying out of the soil and the winds are really causing an increased number. And last but not least, it's my pleasure to give this certificate of appreciation to our Commissioner Scott Smith Cook. Tonight is his last meeting with us, and on behalf of the health agency and the Board of Supervisors, we wanted to say thank you very much for your 5 years of service and present you with this certificate. I know.
I was going to call home right away.
Thank you, Dr. McCarron. Always nice to have you with us. Please come back soon. So let's do commissioner updates. And why don't we start with Commissioner Smith Cook? Do you have anything this
sure.
evening?
Yes. June 6th, I went to the Oral Health Coalition and got updates there. And again, it just so energizes me to hear how much energy is being poured into this area for children's, you know, healthcare, dental healthcare. It's, and then how much is maybe still needs to be done. But it's, these are just awesome people that are really just passionate about getting to our children and making sure that, you know, successes are happening there. There's been a grant that's been talked about. It's called the LDPP grant from the state. The money was supposed to be flowing by September, but the state of California is literally keeps changing the requirements for the grant and making this county go back to the drawing board to clarify and show how they're going to achieve things before any money can flow. And I know it's got to be frustrating for public health, but they're persistent. They're just going through it because it's going to produce things like a virtual dental home, locations where you can literally take your children. You don't have to have a dentist necessarily even present, but just trying to get that outreach to children and connections to having them, you know, reviewed for what is their dental health status. One of the parts of the project will be to try to incentivize dentists to treat children who are on DentiCal. Because it pays so little money, dentists don't want to go after a DentiCal patient. So this grant is going to generate, if the county can finally get the money to flow, about $100 incentive to these dentists for every new patient, new child, to get in their office and start treating. Last meeting, I told you about the fact that they were going to have a clinic up in Templeton where people could get dental care, and that wasn't children only. They did root canals there, extractions, took care of cavities, did hygiene work, and it was all just a walk-in basis. Started at 8 o'clock in the morning, went till 6 in the evening, served many people. They had several people actually lining up at 2 a.m. in the morning because they absolutely wanted to take advantage of this free service. Then the crowds really started to roll in around 5:30, and by 8 a.m. when they opened, they had literally lines wrapping around the block and parking issues, etc. But I'm glad they served so many people that day, because it was not only dental, it was vision. You not only got vision tests, but you could get literally a prescription for your eyeglasses filled on the spot. It was just wonderful, and it will occur next year. They've wrapped up the school year of going into the elementary schools and checking out teeth for kids, so that's happening in the schools. They're even doing it in our county in the preschool settings. One of the challenges I was hearing about at this meeting is now getting the parents connected. You know, so they've looked at the child, they sent a letter home. Some of these are critical need, and how it's just broken, heartbreaking almost, the fact that some of the parents still don't connect their child then with dental care after getting that news. And the other one's hard to serve foster children. Keep in mind that parent is not present. That parent is wherever, incarcerated, wherever that parent might be. So this foster child's protector is the courts. So they have to go to a court and get a judge to enforce that it's okay to give anesthesia to a child to take care of his cavity. So just the slowdown in the process is really something there. But we have a very passionate coalition. It's amazing the amount of energy and the volunteer efforts and that sort of thing. There's Cal Poly's got a dental society group. They were there telling about their results from what they've done. They did a touch on hands with 280 some students, and checked with them later and found out a month later, 94% of them were still brushing, 94% were still flossing. These Cal Poly students really motivated these young children. I was so proud of them. So that's my report for today.
Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about a Wall Street Journal article that came out that was germane to the Tobacco Control Coalition. We know that there's been a lot of restrictions on smoking and taxes on smoking. But in spite of all that, tobacco profits are soaring. And the Wall Street Journal pointed out that in spite of these events, the tobacco industry has found a way to profit. And the article also pointed out that Americans spend more money on cigarettes today than money on beer and soda combined. So that's a very disturbing trend.
So, David, next month is our planning retreat for the commission, and I have a couple of things I'd like to talk to you about, a kind of a long-term project a lot that goes along with the Tobacco Coalition, and that I know as a commission we've been wanting to be more involved sometimes, but I think there's a couple of upcoming opportunities that we might be able to do some things.
Not right now, but at the planning committee next month.
We will assign you things to be doing.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. Chris?
No report this month.
Candace? I have a comment on Scott's report. So I'm the advisor to the Pre-Dental Club, and they're awesome students, and they got the Club of the Year award from the College of Science and Math because they were so active in the community and doing, they were great. This was a great bunch of students, and I think they passed it on to the next people that aren't graduating generation so that it'll continue. Anyway, I'm glad you got to see them. In terms of my own updates, I went to the Opioid Safety Coalition meeting in mid-May, and they had a presentation. Dr. Reibel from the Aegis Treatment Center was there. She's the medical director there, and her presentation was all about access to medication-assisted therapy for those with substance or opioid use disorder, and really talking to especially doctors about reducing the stigma around addiction and increasing the availability of medication-assisted treatment. So that was a great presentation, really informative. I have a lot of details written down if anyone is interested. We also at that meeting talked about their switching from the grant that they were on prior to a new grant that they received with the support of this commission. And they're starting that June with the new fiscal year. It is a smaller grant, so they are going to have to reduce some of the things that they've been doing, but they hope to continue, especially with safe prescribing practices and education, expanding access to that medication-assisted treatment, and education and outreach. So the next meeting is in September.
Just as a follow-up to our Oceano Dunes issue, I think most of you are aware that the APCD sent kind of a warning letter to state parks about their recurring violations. State parks had 30 days to respond. Far as I know, they have not. So it's pretty likely that maybe this week APCD will issue a notice of violation, which apparently has a lot of teeth in it. And if I understand it right, it's always very complex on these things. But I think once a notice of violation has been issued, I should be careful saying this, but I believe it takes it more out of the political realm and gives the air pollution control officer much more leverage to work with it. So we may be actually seeing some results from that. Interestingly, you know, we've mentioned the modeling project that the local APCD and the state has been doing. I understand that their first major phase is complete and that they'll be presenting a detailed report to the APCD board which is meeting here next Wednesday at 9 a.m. It's not, it's out of sequence for when they have their regular meetings. I believe it's their budget meeting. So it might be a really long one, and I'm hoping that there'll be online some sort of a detailed agenda. But I believe the state, the California Air Resources Board, will be presenting their data, and it may be very, very revelatory.
Thanks for working so hard on that letter. It's nice to see that it had some teeth in it. Myself, the Health and Communities Work Group continues to meet the first Thursday of every month, reviewing plans. And you'll recall, we started out with just reviewing things that went through the County Planning Commission that were not related to our villages or our cities, but the county. We have moved upward, and we're getting asked to do reviews from two of our cities now. We got the first one from Atascadero last month, so that was the first one. There is a project that has come up again. It was before the Board of Supervisors several years ago. Our past chairman, Ed Garena, had originally brought it up. It was the quarry out in Santa Margarita, and that has been proposed once again. So there, I think, will be an opportunity for the Health Commission to look at a couple things and make some health related comments on that. The other thing I have is that Chris and I were on the committee that reviewed the preventive health grant and the community-based organization grants. I was going to say tomorrow. Tomorrow's Tuesday, right? Wednesday of this week. This is budget hearings at the Board of Supervisors. Wednesdays, they will be looking at those recommendations and awarding those grants. So we'll be able to bring you the final results probably next meeting. With that, I think that completes our commissioner updates. Any committee reports? Budget, legislative, community education, nominating. David, I believe, do you have something from the nominating committee? David doesn't. Jean?
I don't know if someone wants to make a motion to accept the recommendation for
so the nominating committee has met, correct? Or they've gotten together at least, and are recommending our executive committee or slate of officers for the 2017-2018 year, which actually would remain the same that we did this year. So we do need to have a motion to accept their recommendations so that we can all vote on it.
So move.
Second.
Thank you. I think we'll just do a show of hands. All those in favor of accepting the recommendations, please say aye. Let's do it that way. Aye. Those opposed? Recommendations accepted. Prospective future items, we'll certainly be talking about that at our next meeting in July, which is our annual planning retreat. We'll not be here at the Board of Supervisors, but we'll be over at Public Health starting at 6 o'clock again. Please bring all of your ideas for, we have a few carryover items from our December planning meeting that we do have on the schedule for the first couple of meetings of the new fiscal year, but we need lots of ideas for other things. Also bring any ideas that you have for long-term projects that we might get involved in. A couple things have come up and we will be talking about those, but there may be other things out there that you all know about or that are of interest to any of you, and we would like to hear about those as well. So before we close this evening, again, thank you, Commissioner Smith-Cook, for your time on the commission with us. We will miss you, but enjoy, okay? With that, we'll be adjourned.